Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, July 20, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about the most recent Supreme Court action taken on President Trump's immigration moratorium and executive action. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Josh Blackman, Associate Professor of Law at South Texas College of Law at Houston, and Professor Ilya Soman, Professor of Law at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. I will turn it over to Professor Blackman to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Josh. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here today with my good friend and colleague, Ilya Soman, and the Federal Society. I appreciate the invitation. Yesterday, the Supreme Court issued a one-paragraph order in the ongoing litigation over President Trump's travel ban. My goal today is to give you a brief history of the case, where it began, the Supreme Court's first review of it back in June, what happened yesterday, and what happens next. So back in the early days of the Trump administration, feels like forever ago, it was barely 6 months, the president issued what he called a travel ban. This was a policy that would have denied entry to aliens from seven predominantly Muslim nations and imposed restrictions on the admission of refugees from around the world. That went through the courts, and the courts of appeals ruled that it was unconstitutional. That case was not appealed to the Supreme Court. Instead, the Trump administration went back to the drawing board and drew a second version up. The second version was now down to six countries where aliens were banned. That was excluding Iraq, and also placed other limitations on refugees. An important point is that the second order also had a waiver process that if various relatives could demonstrate a hardship, they would be allowed to enter into the United States. That was also challenged in courts, and a district court judge in Hawaii and another judge in Maryland entered global injunctions, barring their enforcement, finding that they were unconstitutional. Both of those decisions were appealed. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, based in Richmond, held that the order was a violation of the Establishment Clause. It was based on the president's animus towards Muslims. The Ninth Circuit took a different route. They ruled on statutory grounds. They held that President Trump has not demonstrated that the people he seeks to deny entry to would in fact be detrimental to U.S. interests. They may be detrimental, but he hasn't met the requisite showing. At that point, the government appealed to the Supreme Court, and they sought several things. They sought certiorari. They sought a stay. Most experts predicted that the court would deny cert and would not grant the stay. I wasn't one of those experts. The court ultimately did both. They granted certiorari, and they scheduled arguments for October, and they also granted a stay. Now, the stay was done purely on equitable grounds, and maybe Ilya and I can talk later about tea leaves, but this court tried really hard not to rule on the merits. What did the court actually rule? They said that with respect to refugees who haven't had prior contact with the United States, and it wasn't well defined, they could be denied entry. And people with no connections to the United States, they could be denied entry as well. But if a person has a bona fide close connection to the United States, they have to be let in. This was a term the court did not define. Justice Thomas wrote a dissenting opinion saying that this will be unworkable, that no one's going to know what a close relationship is. Surprise, surprise, within a couple of days we were back in federal court in Hawaii, and the plaintiff said that the government was denying close relatives admission, specifically grandma, grandpa, grandson, granddaughter, aunt, uncle, niece, nephews, and cousins, and I think I got all of them. The argument was that these are close relatives and the government lacks any meaningful basis to deny them entry. The Solicitor General countered that this was based on immigration law, and immigration law, though harsh, often draws arbitrary lines between family members on a nuclear basis, not grandma, grandpa, but mom, dad, brother, sister. The federal district court in Hawaii initially ruled that he did not have jurisdiction to enter the relief because Hawaii had improperly pleaded the case. Within about 15 minutes, I'm only slightly exaggerating, the Ninth Circuit said, no, here's how you do it, here's how you file your case, and Neil Katyal took a hint. So they filed back in district court. They sought the relief was basically an injunction. And then about a couple of days later, after the briefing was done, the district judge in Hawaii ruled that, in fact, they needed to admit grandma and grandpa and that the refugee portion of the government's policy was not complying with the Supreme Court's decision. So then there are two points, right? The close family members, number one, and the refugees, number two. Okay, at that point, the government did something that Ilya alluded to earlier was somewhat strange. They filed several motions in rapid fire. They filed a notice of appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Immediately after that, they filed with the Supreme Court a motion for clarification, or in the alternative, a petition for certiorari, or in the alternative, a petition for a stay. Basically, they threw the kitchen sink at the Supreme Court. After that was filed, they went back down to the Ninth Circuit and actually filed a brief. But this was, as we say, pro forma. It wasn't real. They needed to do that in order to actually request certiorari before judgment. So indeed, they bypassed the Ninth Circuit, although a brief was filed there. Okay, what happened next? The briefing went on for a couple days. Virtually all the experts said the court won't grant any relief. They'll deny the stay, everything else. Once again, without recorded dissent, the justices issued something of a divided ruling. So yesterday we got this one-paragraph decision from the court. The court didn't reference the portion of Judge Watson's ruling concerning close family members. There was simply nothing about that. They did reference the refugee portion. So what the court said was that we will stay Judge Watson's ruling as to the admission of certain refugees who don't have a prior connection to the United States. The court said nothing about the admission of grandma, grandpa. There was a dissent from Justices Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito. They would have stayed Judge Watson's ruling in whole. So as it stands now, if you are the grandma, grandpa, grandson, granddaughter of a U.S. person, you will be excused from the travel ban for the foreseeable future. But a number of refugees who would have sought admission will now be out of luck. This is a long way of saying that this case has had a tortured posture. What comes next? The court scheduled oral arguments for October 10th, the second week of the term. If you thought last term was something of a snoozer, this term is going to be blazing hot, or as they say on Twitter, lit. The court will have to consider a number of issues, the first and foremost of which is mootness. One of the questions presented that the court granted on last month is this entire dispute moot? Don't forget, this entire travel ban was meant to be a 90-day temporary policy. That 90-day clock is ticking away, and I'm not very good at math, but if my math is right, before the first Monday in October, that 90-day window will have closed. What does that mean for this case? Well, a couple things. First, you may have a situation where the Trump administration withdraws the policy and says, look, we've had this 90-day run. We don't need this anymore. We are going to issue a permanent immigration policy. Or maybe President Trump says 90 days wasn't enough. I need 180 days. Does that automatically moot the case? Not necessarily. There is a doctrine known as voluntary cessation. And this often comes up when, say, you have a police department that's engaging in brutality. And the sheriff says to the court, listen, we've stopped being brutal. We've stopped brutalizing people. Dismiss the case. And the judge says, I don't believe it. There's a chance you may resume that unconstitutional conduct. We're gonna keep this case. So even if the executive order is yanked, there's still a chance that the justices decide to go ahead and resolve it because there's a credible threat that they may implement this in a different name only. Instead of calling it Travel Ban 2.0, it's Travel Ban 3.0. So I'm going to use my remaining few moments to talk about the merits of the case. The Supreme Court's decision from last month was very careful not to discuss the merits. And I don't pretend that this was accidental. There were no dissents. The chief and probably others worked meticulously to get people like Justice Ginsburg or Sotomayor on board. But there's a couple of things that are worth pointing out about the per curiam decision from last month. One of the arguments advanced by the Ninth Circuit is that the government has zero basis to make these determinations, right? That the executive order in no way supports the statutory basis of saying that a person would be detrimental. If that was the case, then the government could not have allowed the injunction to go into effect as to anyone, right? By saying that there's no basis to deny anyone access, the court should simply deny the stay. They didn't do that. They effectively said, well, maybe some people without connections are dangerous, and maybe some people with connections are. So I think there's tea leaves, so to speak, on the question of whether the president has a statutory authority. The second argument concerns the Establishment Clause. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that the president's actions were dripping, I think that was the word, dripping with racial animus. I'm sorry, not religious animus, wrong case, was dripping with religious animus in all of its manifest glory, and that the entire policy is void ab initio, that it can't go into effect at all. If that were the case, then the Supreme Court should not have let anyone be banned by it. The fact that some people now are being denied entry by this policy suggests that at least the majority of the court, you only need five, are comfortable with the fact that this order is not dripping with animus, that it can be constitutional in some of its respects. So while the justices were very careful not to weigh in on the merits, the fact that they're allowing it to go into effect at least in part suggests that a majority has concluded that maybe the order is at least in part lawful, which is perhaps not a good news for the government, but it's at least better news that the shake they'll get is better than that which they received in the lower courts. I will stop here and turn it over to Ilya, and I can answer all of your questions after later on the call. Thank you very much.
So I'd like to start by thanking the Federalist Society for organizing this call in short notice, and Josh for his very thoughtful remarks. It's always an honor to be on one of these events with Josh, who is not only my former student, but more importantly is one of the nation's best young law professors. He'd already achieved a great deal in his career. I think Josh and I actually agree on a very wide range of constitutional issues. We do tend to disagree a lot on issues related to immigration, and also on even more important issues related to the New York Yankees, of which Josh is a big fan, and I am very much not. So perhaps we'll talk about that later. I do agree, actually, with a good deal of what Josh said in his opening statement. In particular, for the most part, he gave a good overview of the case and where it stands and where it's likely to go. So in my remarks, rather than trying to recapitulate everything, I'll just focus on a few points where I think Josh and I may differ, or where perhaps Josh, for lack of time, didn't cover some of the issues as thoroughly as he potentially could have. So I'll start by briefly talking about the June 26 decision and what it means, then a little bit about the posture of the dispute over how to interpret that June 26 decision. And then finally, about the tea leaves, about where the case might go from here, where, you know, I think there is a good deal of uncertainty about what will happen, and it may be that Josh and I agree on that. So I do agree with Josh with respect to the June 26th ruling, that it very carefully avoided the issue of the merits, and also that there is potentially some room for dispute about exactly what it means with respect to which parts of the injunctions against the travel ban stay in place going forward and which parts are now lifted. However, I think things are somewhat more clear in that ruling than perhaps Josh suggests. In particular, the ruling says that so long that you can stay and not be affected by the travel ban, so long as you have a plausible claim of a bona fide relationship with the U.S. person or entity. Notice it doesn't even have to be an actual bona fide relationship, just a defensible or plausible claim. And with respect to relatives and what that means, the court actually gave us some guidance. They said that a mother-in-law of a resident of the United States counts as a sufficiently close relative. One of the plaintiffs in one of the cases actually was a person who was trying to get his mother-in-law into the country. If a mother-in-law is a sufficiently close relative, it stands to reason that anybody who is as close a relative or closer than that also is a sufficiently close relative, and grandmothers, grandfathers, uncles, and most if not all of the other people covered by Judge Watchin's decision on the family part of this, those people surely are covered as well. Frankly, this is not at all rocket science. You don't have to be a very sophisticated lawyer, an expert in immigration law, or anything like that, to see the point that a grandmother is at least as close a relative as a mother-in-law is. And Judge Watchin, I think, quite rightly ruled on that basis. And the Supreme Court, in turn, I think, quite rightly chose not to even consider disturbing that part of his ruling. Indeed, the fact that the administration chose to resist on the grandmother's point either suggests serious incompetence on their part or, to my mind, a willful effort to try to resist the June 26 Supreme Court ruling. The issue of the refugees is a bit more complicated, but even so, there is a good deal of guidance with respect to that issue in the Supreme Court's decision. In particular, when they talked about what it means to have a bona fide relationship with a U.S. entity, the court said that it has to be a relationship that's in the ordinary course of business. It has to be formalized in some way, and it can't be created just for the sake of getting around the executive order. And as Judge Watchin and many experts in immigration law have pointed out, assurances given by U.S. refugee resettlement organizations actually fit this definition almost to a T. In particular, they're formalized. The organization commits to providing fairly extensive assistance to the particular individual in question. They're part of the ordinary course of business. This is standard practice with refugee resettlement and has been for a long time. And because it's standard practice, it can't be described as being created just to get around the executive order. So therefore, it fits the definition pretty well. There may be other cases, whether involving refugees or other categories of people, where it's hard to tell whether there's a sufficiently clear bona fide relationship. I do agree with Justice Thomas that, you know, the Supreme Court's decision is not as precise as it could have been, but I think it covers this refugee situation. Now, what does the Supreme Court's extremely brief and laconic order yesterday mean for all this? One, as I said before, is I think they're probably unwilling to disturb what Judge Watchin did with respect to the relatives issue. They know that that issue will now go to the Ninth Circuit, which will almost certainly affirm what Judge Watchin did on that. On the refugee issue, it's possible that their willingness to stay Judge Watchin's injunction on that point means that the justices have some hesitancy about the refugee question. On the other hand, however, they know that the Ninth Circuit will take up this issue relatively quickly, most likely, and that there is a high likelihood that the Ninth Circuit, which has generally ruled against the administration on travel ban issues, will do the same thing here. And significantly, they turned down the Trump administration's invitation to intervene on the merits of either of these disputes themselves. And obviously the reason why the administration wanted the Supreme Court to weigh in is because they thought probably correctly that they were more likely to succeed in the Supreme Court than with the Ninth Circuit. I think it's very likely that the Ninth Circuit will affirm Judge Watchin on both of these issues. This will probably happen sooner rather than later. It's possible that the Supreme Court will then simply refuse to take up the Ninth Circuit decision. It's also possible, however, that they will take it up. And if they do, I think it's very unlikely they'll do anything on the, anything significant on the relatives front. They might do something with respect to refugees. I would be somewhat surprised if they completely adopted the administration's position there, but it's possible that they will try to create tighter rules on exactly what counts as a formal assurance and a bona fide relationship and the like. Now for In the last couple minutes that I have, I'd like to talk about tea leaves for the future. I preface this by saying that what happens in the Supreme Court is very likely to depend on what Justice Kennedy, the key swing voter, wants to do, and perhaps Chief Justice Roberts. And I have told journalists and others that I have given up trying to predict what Justice Kennedy is likely to do in a close and controversial case, because I've put my foot in my mouth on that question a couple times before, and it's obvious his mind just works along different tracks than not only than my mind does, but than a lot of people's minds. He's just a difficult guy to predict. Therefore, all I can say is, honestly, we don't know which way Justice Kennedy is going to turn on this. I also think there's some doubt about which way Chief Justice Roberts will turn, because I think Roberts will be tempted, perhaps, to try to find some sort of compromise where, you know, each side gets something, at least if Roberts is the key swing vote. That said, I think the tea leaves of the June 26th decision are not as favorable to the government as Josh says that they are, and the key reason is this. That likelihood of success on the merits is just one of several requirements that plaintiffs must meet in order to get a preliminary injunction. So it's possible that with respect to the people who don't have the necessary bona fide relationship with the United States, it's possible that the court thought that some or maybe even all of them do have a likelihood of success on the merits, but they don't have a sufficient equitable claim that they would actually suffer significant harm. In particular, a great many of those people, perhaps even the vast majority, probably would not be able to enter the United States anyway, even in the absence of the travel ban executive order. If they don't have relatives, they don't have any relationship, it's actually quite difficult from these six countries to get a visa into the U.S. And there might also be other reasons as well why they thought that those people don't qualify for a preliminary injunction for reasons unrelated to their likelihood of success on the merits. On the other hand, with respect to the categories of people that are able to enter under at least the most plausible interpretation of preliminary injunction standard, those people do have to meet the requirement of a likelihood of success on the merits. And so the fact that the Supreme Court said that the injunction can apply to those people is at least a sign, not a completely definitive sign, but it's a sign that a majority of justices believe those people do have a likelihood of success on the merits, though I hasten to add that the Supreme Court can and sometimes does play fast and loose with the preliminary injunction test, and Justice Kennedy in particular is not known for his love of legal formalism in this context or perhaps many other contexts as well. There could be a Supreme Court majority that believes that all or the vast majority of the travel ban is unconstitutional, or alternatively that it doesn't meet statutory requirements, but yet they also don't want to have as sweeping a preliminary injunction as existed before. So what will happen in the future, as I said, I don't know for sure, but Josh is probably right that there is a good likelihood that the Supreme Court will ultimately decide that the issue is moot because more than the 90 days will have passed by the time oral argument is held, much less by the time the Supreme Court is able to issue any kind of decision. It's possible that for the reasons Josh mentioned, the Supreme Court will decide the case is not moot. I would note one last small but potentially significant issue. If the Supreme Court does decide the case is moot, there is some question about whether that would vacate the lower court judgments against the Trump administration or not. One branch of doctrine says that it would, in that in cases where a case becomes moot due to an appeal, during the pendency of an appeal, lower court judgments are supposed to be vacated. But there is an exception to the doctrine which says that if the party that lost below causes the case to be moot through its own actions, then the lower court judgment might stay in place. And here, I think you could argue the administration has caused a case to be moot through its own actions because they're the ones who set the 90-day timeline to begin with. But I hasten to add, I'm not an expert in this particular branch of civil procedure, so I might be missing something. And even if I'm not missing something, the Supreme Court has a great deal of discretion with respect to these sorts of things. And so it's possible that this issue, like perhaps some parts of the June 26th order, will be decided not based on the letter of the law, but based on some kind of compromise that Chief Justice Roberts or somebody else on the court decides to broker. And while I decry these sorts of practices, sometimes these compromises are based on what swing justices believe is good for the court rather than based on technical legal considerations. Josh and I are both veterans of the debate over the individual mandate in Obamacare, where many people believe that Chief Justice Roberts brokered a compromise that was good for the court, or at least that he thought was good for the court, and that compromise had some problems from the standpoint of legal doctrine. So more can be said, but I think I'll stop there. Thank you so much, and I look forward to the questions.
Great. Josh, is there anything you would like to respond to before we go to questions?
Absolutely. So I did some research on Supreme Court practice, and on the Roberts Court, since the Chief Justice joined, where the court, number one, granted a stay, and number two, granted certiorari, after oral arguments, in 22 out of 24 cases, the court reversed. Let me say that again. On the Roberts Court, where the court grants a stay, and then grant certiorari, they reverse in 22 out of 24 cases. In all 22 of those, Justice Kennedy was in the majority. So from this small window where Justice Kennedy wants to put something on hold, at least in part, he ultimately reverses in part. To the extent that does anything, I don't think Hawaii is getting a complete victory. I think at a minimum, the government gets a partial victory, whether that's a compromise, as Ilya said or not, I don't quite know. But the notion that the Ninth Circuit's opinion will be affirmed in whole, and the Fourth Circuit's opinion affirmed in whole, I am pretty sure that's not going to happen.
Can I comment briefly?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm not as convinced by this research as Josh is, though I saw the post where he wrote it up, and he did a good job going through these cases. One reason is that I think it's also important that the Supreme Court upheld the lower court injunctions and upheld it in practice with respect to quite likely the large majority of the people who otherwise could have gotten in under the previous rules. Secondly, I do think that this case has a lot more visibility than perhaps any of those 20 for others, or certainly the vast majority of them, and raises a number of unique and important issues, and therefore I'm not convinced that those previous cases are going to have a lot of predictive value. And indeed, Josh himself in his blog post on this points out that this case is hardly the normal situation. But as I said before, I'm not predicting that Hawaii will win. I'm not even necessarily predicting that they will win anything. All I'm saying is that the tea leaves from the June 26th decision do not point clearly against them, and that there are even some tea leaves that might point in their favor, such as the idea that the June 26th decision would not have upheld large parts of the injunctions if the majority of the justices did not think that there are many plaintiffs who have a likelihood of success on the merits. That said, as I said before, I've often been wrong, at least in recent years, about what Justice Kennedy may or may not do, and I fully admit I could easily be misunderstanding him here, too.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll ask one of my own. What might happen going forward in terms of the interpretation of the June 26th case? And when the Supreme Court finally takes up the case in October, though, you both have talked about that a little.
This is Josh. The June 26th opinion, again, was purely an equitable decision. The entire idea of close family members, bona fide, you know, these are all things the court made up of whole cloth, right? These aren't terms defined by the statute or by the executive order. So I don't think any of this will matter. The questions presented are, does this violate the Due Process Clause, does this violate the Establishment Clause, and does this violate the does this go beyond the President's statutory authority? So all these little intermediary, you know, equitable things, those go away, and you go to the core of the constitutional question. It might be possible to split the baby, so to speak, with respect to these interim questions. I don't know how they do that with the Establishment Clause. If this policy is tainted by religious animus, which is what the Fourth Circuit held, you can't enforce it as to anyone, regardless of its grandma or grandpa. If the president has not made a showing that these people are dangerous, you can't enforce it as to anyone, whether it's grandma, grandpa, or a refugee. So this sort of splitting the baby goes away once you address the merits.
So Josh's remarks raise a couple of issues. One is the question of the June 26 judgment and what will happen with that, and the other is whether you can split the baby in the fall. On the first question, I think the June 26 judgment is a bit more important than Josh says it is because, yes, in terms of long-term constitutional interpretation may not be that significant. On the other hand, there are real refugees out there and real people with relatives in the United States and so forth, and those people are suffering, and some of them will suffer great harm if they're not let in. So the question of what does the June 26 judgment mean for refugees and other categories of people is actually somewhat significant. Moreover, while I think Josh is right that the Supreme Court sort of, you know, made this stuff up and it doesn't have clear precedent in either statutory or constitutional law. Their decision does have some intuitive basis in that the intuition here is that people who have an established connection, on average at least, will suffer greater harm if they're kept out than people who don't have any such connection, particularly perhaps people who probably wouldn't get in anyway. So I think there is some intuitive logic behind what the court did, and as the court says, equitable judgment is an area where courts have a lot of discretion. So my view is I would have much preferred if they would have just upheld the lower court injunctions in their entirety, but I think what they actually did is not as completely implausible and ridiculous as many people say that it is. Not exactly high praise for their baby-splitting exercise, but I don't think it's as you know, it's as awful as, you know, a lot of people suggest. In terms of splitting the baby in the fall, I personally there too would prefer that they just affirmed what the Fourth Circuit did, but I think actually there are ways to split the baby. One is they could say that people who have no previous connection to the United States, they simply aren't able to have standing to raise claims that, you know, about either the Establishment Clause or perhaps the statutory issue either. So that would be a way to split the baby and would track the June 26 decision. I don't know if the baby will in fact be split in this way, but this is a strategy to pursue. The second possible baby splitting approach would be to say, to rest on the so-called plenary power doctrine, which in its most extreme form says that constitutional restrictions on government power, including individual rights, don't apply to immigration policy as it relates to aliens abroad who have no previous contact with the U.S., and the court could say that the plenary power doctrine says that the Establishment Clause doesn't apply to those people, but it does apply to people who do have various contacts, including relatives, agreements with refugee organizations, perhaps a variety of others. I personally would prefer restricting the plenary power doctrine much more than that, because I think the plenary power doctrine is made up judicial activism, not doesn't comport with the text and original meaning of the Constitution, but this is a very plausible compromise and one that might be attractive to some justices. There are perhaps other ways of splitting the baby as well, but I actually think if the Supreme Court does reach the merits in the fall, and it may not because of mootness, but if it does, some sort of baby splitting exercise is a very plausible outcome of the court's deliberations. Not the only possible outcome by any means, but I think it's plausible.
Let's go to our first question from the audience.
Hi, this is Jacob Weil from the Barry University School of Law. I was wondering if you guys could just touch a little bit on what would be the outcome in the lower courts if it was decided that this case is moot. I believe Professor Soman had mentioned that it might vacate the previous decisions made, but what would that actually look like if it were to be determined that it was moot?
I'll start because Ilya introduced it. There's a doctrine called Munsingware. Not underwear, Munsingware. And the doctrine states generally that when a case becomes moot on appeal, while the appeal is pending, the lower court decision is vacated. Ilya noted correctly, there's an exception to this where if the party at interest does something deliberately to moot the case, the decision below might not be vacated. Now, before we answer those sort of CivPro questions, I am not very interested in whether the lower court decision is vacated. Now, from a precedential perspective, we could say, wow, it's great that that opinion was wiped off the books. It was completely wrong, which I think they were. But what difference does it make? If this comes back to the Ninth Circuit, they'll cite it just the same, say, well, we think it's persuasive, even though it's been vacated. So the idea of whether this is binding precedent in the Ninth Circuit, I think, makes not a lick of difference.
I agree with a good deal of what Josh said, but I do think it makes some difference in that if it is binding precedent, it at least applies to lower courts in the Ninth Circuit, or in the case of the Fourth Circuit, to lower courts there. Moreover, even if similar cases arise in other circuits in the future, often circuit judges are reluctant to create a circuit split. So in one sense, Josh is surely right in that even if these decisions are vacated, you know, that doesn't mean people will just forget about them, and certainly the reasoning and logic will be available to other courts, but you know, the technical legalities do make some difference. I would also reiterate what I said earlier in that if the Supreme Court decides this is moot, I think there's a good chance that their decision on whether to vacate the lower court opinions or not will be determined not just by the technical aspects of the Munsingware doctrine or even the underwear doctrine, but rather by what Chief Justice Roberts and others think is good judicial statesmanship. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that would be a good thing if they decided based on that, but I think there's a good likelihood that they in fact would.
I'll add a recent example. There was the Grimm, the GG versus Gloucester County case involving Title IX and transgender bathroom rights. And during the change in administrations, the Trump administration yanked the memo. That could have been a case where under Munsingware you vacate or not, and the court did GVR. They granted, vacated, and remanded. So if they follow the precedent set in the Gloucester County case, then this case should be I think the Ninth Circuit opinion will be not long for this world.
Could be, although did the Supreme Court even issue an opinion in the City of Gloucester case as to why they're vacating?
No, I think it was a GVR.
Okay. So so there's not much reasoning there, and there's probably ways a court, if it wanted to, could distinguish that. Like I said before, I think with high-profile cases, whether it be the transgender case or this one, it may be that the court's consideration of, you know, what they think is good policy or good for the judiciary may trump, so to speak, you know, technical aspects of the Munsingware doctrine, or in this case, a precedent that doesn't even include any reasoning.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Hi, it's Dave Trine in Cleveland. I had a question about Justice Ginsburg. So she has expressed a significant amount of hostility towards President Trump. And I'm wondering if the government has or ought to file a motion for her to recuse herself, or if she ought to do so sua sponte, or if and even indeed what the chances might be of her doing so.
I can go first if you like. So yes, I think the administration certainly could file such a motion, and Justice Ginsburg did express very negative views about Trump during the election. I think it's very unlikely that Justice Ginsburg actually will recuse herself. I think, you know, that's and she essentially has nearly complete discretion to decide whether she should recuse herself or not. And the more interesting question is whether she should do so as a matter of discretionary judgment. I think that she doesn't have an ethical obligation to recuse herself, because I think the issue here is not so much what she said, but you know, whether she has bias in her mind. And it's clear that, you know, she has a very negative view of Trump, but in highly polarized times, you often have situations where one or more justices have very negative views of a particular president. Certainly, I bet many of the conservative judges had very negative views of Obama, and they didn't recuse themselves in the Obamacare cases or other cases that you know, were centrally important to Obama. Moreover, there's even a little bit of a precedent for not recusing yourself in a situation involving a statement, in that Justice O'Connor apparently remarked during the 2000 election that she really did not want to see Gore defeat Bush. She was not a fan of his, and nonetheless, she didn't recuse herself in Bush versus Gore, which directly involved Gore's political fate much more than the travel ban case involves Trump's fate. Now, to be sure, O'Connor made these remarks in private at a party where a lot of people were present. It later leaked out that she said it. But again, I think the issue here is not so much whether the remark is public or private, but rather the mental state that it reflects, because bias is a mental state. It's not, you can be biased and not say anything about your bias.
The justices are not subject to any code. They do what they want. Next question.
If I could summarize that on one foot. If she doesn't recuse herself, is she going to be subjecting herself to a presidential tweet?
Quite possibly. Trump has already tweeted about her. I suspect that won't deter Justice Ginsburg.
Is this a new writ called the tweet of entweetment?
The writ of entweetment, that could be perhaps...
Yeah, I think we have a new writ.
Thank you.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi. Do you think that the Supreme Court will decide on the Establishment Clause issue discussed by the Fourth Circuit, such as if the Mandel test is actually a two-part test, which would allow the court to look at the intent behind the stated purpose based on the showing of bad faith and allow the use of the Lemon test? Do you think they're more likely to discuss the statutory analysis from the Ninth Circuit?
I'll start there. One of the points that I've been making since the outset is that the court has never applied the Establishment Clause in the context of immigration. Never. We have immigration laws in the books that make express preferences for evangelical Christians. It says that right in the statute. If the court says that the president's immigration decisions are bound by the Establishment Clause, there are entire swaths of law that become now in doubt. A lot of refugee law involves serious entanglement between state and church. These are issues which the Fourth Circuit just leapfrogged over because it didn't really matter. So I think there are certain conceptual barriers before reaching this. The other question is, to what extent can they consider President Trump's statements in the campaign trail, statements from before he was even a candidate, statements after the election, his tweets, his this, his that? Again, these are very difficult questions, and it's one the court hasn't squarely addressed. So to reach the Establishment Clause question, there are a lot of hurdles to go over. The statutory question might seem a lot neater, but the devil is always in the details. If the court holds that the president didn't make the requisite findings to show that these people are detrimental, that can be cured by another executive order. So it might be a temporary setback, but not a permanent one. Once it's a constitutional question, that's something the president can't cure.
So I don't know if they're going to reach the establishment question or not. They might not even reach either the establishment question or the statutory question, because they could just decide the case is moot, as we've discussed at some length before. I do think the establishment issue is not quite as difficult as Josh suggests. One is these previous distinctions in immigration law specifically single out groups that have been subjected to systematic persecution by their governments. And in many cases, it doesn't require the U.S. to somehow classify people based on religion. The classification is based on, you know, the practices of the government in question. It's targeting people for persecution. I think there's a much more clear Establishment Clause violation in a situation where the government acts based on animus against a religious group to disadvantage them than in a situation where the government, where what the government does is you know, single out a group that has been singled out by a foreign government for special persecution. And some of the groups in question, Josh and I have debated this before a little bit, such as Soviet Jews are not even actually a religious group at all. I'm actually myself a Soviet Jewish immigrant, but I'm an atheist, as were my parents when immigrated. Being Jewish was under the Soviet government simply a line that the government put in your passport off completely independently, usually, of what your actual religious beliefs were. So I think there would be some difficulties here, but and it would be a very important decision, but I think the difficulties would be somewhat less than Josh suggests. I would say the same thing about the issue of Trump's tweets and statements. Essentially, what this is a pretextual discrimination case. It's a case that says that something that on its face is neutral is actually motivated by religious bias or, in some other cases, racial or ethnic bias. And the Supreme Court has long said that in dealing with such cases, you have to look at the surrounding circumstances of the enactment of that policy, and Trump's statements and his commitments are clearly part of those surrounding circumstances. And indeed, both common sense and a lot of empirical social science say that presidents and other politicians' campaign promises are a very powerful predictor of what they're going to do in office. Now, I hasten to add that in such cases, the presence of a discriminatory motive doesn't by itself prove that the law is or that the action is unconstitutional. The government gets a chance to prove that they would have done the same thing anyway, despite the discriminatory motive. But I think you know, there is a lot of relevant precedent and evidence here that could be addressed. That said, it's certainly possible the court will decide the statutory issue is easier and will decide to set this one aside. It all comes down to, I think, what would be more attractive to Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy. And certainly Roberts might find the statutory issue more attractive for precisely the reasons that Josh indicates. And with Kennedy, as I've said before, I find it very hard to predict what he will or will not do.
I'll take this break to make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, July 21st at 2 p.m. That call will be on antitrust enforcement in the modern era and will feature the Honorable Joshua D. Wright, Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. But not seeing any, would both of you like to make some closing remarks?
I'll go first. Let me say this bluntly. A lot of the experts in this case should reevaluate their expertise. Without fail, when this case went up to the court in June, all the experts said the court will deny the stay. The court will deny cert. This case has no merit. And the court did something in between. They granted a stay and they granted cert. When the motion for clarification was filed last week, the experts all said there's no merit here. Grandparents and grandparents, the refugees, this is such an easy case. And then the court granted some middle relief. As I've been saying from the outside, this case is a lot stronger for the government than the lower courts have suggested. And to date, the courts seem to reflect that. In fact, Josh Matt, the Lawfare blog, has a good post along these lines, which somewhat mirrors my own sentiments. The court's signaling to the lower courts, you guys are getting it wrong. This is not the case you think it is. The law is perhaps on the president's side, at least in part. So I think a lot of people may be surprised with the outcome of this decision come October, whenever they hear it. Of course, if they decide to dump it on mootness, fine, but if they decide to take it on the merits, the outcome may not be what people think it is.
So I've already covered earlier in this teleforum why I think Josh's assessment of the June 26th decision and what it means is not as favorable for the government as he thinks it is. I certainly think it is possible that the court will rule in favor of the government on some or even perhaps all of the disputed issues, but that is very far from certain. And indeed, there are some indications in the June 26th decision that the plaintiffs could win on a lot of important issues. As for the experts' predictions, I think certainly there are some experts who made wrong predictions. On the other hand, a lot of people, including myself, thought that it was quite likely that the Supreme Court would grant cert because of the importance of the issue and the deep divisions that it has created. That was, you know, always my opinion and that of, I think, a lot of experts that I saw comment on it. Indeed, the experts that I saw claiming that cert might be denied painted themselves as going against dominant opinion. On the grandparents question, I think there's no reason to question the dominant view among experts that that was a very easy case. Indeed, the Supreme Court completely refused the Trump administration's demands with respect to that issue. On the refugee question, as I noted earlier, that might be closer, but it's notable that the Supreme Court refused to intervene in that beyond granting what will likely be a short stay. But that issue is more uncertain, I think, than the issue of the relatives. I would also raise this one last point, both with respect to the grandparents' question and with respect to the overall handling of many aspects of this issue by the administration. There has been a combination of bad faith and disorganization. As Benjamin Wittes famously put it, malevolence tempered by incompetence. And that might make some key swing justices reluctant to just give the administration everything it wants at the margin. They might want to say, we don't want to reward this kind of behavior. That's not, strictly speaking, a legal consideration, but swing justices are sometimes influenced by this sorts of things. And I would add that to the extent that part of the issue here is the so-called presumption of regularity, the presumption that what the administration is doing is on the legal up and up. It may well be not just that this presumption doesn't work well with this administration, but perhaps that this presumption should be given less weight in general in the future, because in the modern, highly polarized environment that we're in, where lots of administrations of both parties push at the limits of what is legally permissible, maybe we should require administrations to prove that what they're doing is legal rather than simply presuming it.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.